It's the Marketplace Tech Podcast for Thursday, April 16th. I'm Noelle King in Los Angeles, in for Ben Johnson. EU regulators say Google violated fair competition rules by directing its search engine users toward Google products, which raises a question. If Google is found to have broken the law, how might it have to change? James Grimmelman teaches technology law at the University of Maryland Law School, and he says if you look back at what happened when Microsoft lost a similar antitrust suit 15 years ago, you might get an idea.
It was forced to include a ballot. When you start up Windows, you are presented with a screen listing a number of choices of different browsers, and you can pick which one will be the default. And the idea was to give a level playing field. The natural analogy for that on Google search would be that Google Shopping wouldn't occupy any special position. Other search engines that do comparison shopping could show up in the same place that Google Shopping would, either on some kind of even-handed algorithmic basis or randomly.
Speaking of online shopping, Etsy, the e-marketplace that offers small vendors a platform to market their goods, is expected to start trading on the NASDAQ today. And the company is offering its vendors what you might call a perk, an opportunity to buy Etsy stock ahead of its initial public offering. Santosh Rao is head of research at Manhattan Venture Partners. Hey, Santosh.
Hi.
So Etsy has 1.5 million vendors, give or take, and it set aside 5% of its stock for them as an option to buy. Why did it do that?
Well, for two reasons, I would say. One is legal and one is strategic. Legal because it's a B Corp, and if it can do good for the community, for the consumers, for the vendors, it satisfies the B Corp requirements and gives them a good rating. And secondly, is a strategic reason. I would say they need to keep the vendors happy. 80% of their business is repeat customers, and loyalty is important for the company.
One of the things to your first point that's really interesting here is that we think of the people who are able to buy stock off of the back of an IPO as wealthier people, and Etsy's vendors are not. Many of them are people who make around the median income of the United States or even less. These are very small business people. So they're getting an opportunity here that they might not necessarily get anywhere else.
Yes, they should realize that there are risks with any IPO. The stock may pop, may not pop. Nothing wrong in having them come in, and especially this one where they're committed to the community.
Why does Etsy have such a loyal customer and vendor base? How have they maintained that?
Well, that's part of their mission. It was designed originally for that. It wasn't meant to be a big, high-scale commercial operation. And that's where they made the market, and that's why they're doing well.
How does it stay that way after going public?
Well, there's some advantages to a B Corp. They don't necessarily have to look at the bottom line every quarter. In the end, they have to show a path to profitability to show that they are a good business, but there's no near-term absolute imperative to show a profit.
Well, Etsy took in almost $200 million in revenue last year, but it's still not profitable. Why is that?
Well, they were profitable for a long time, actually. And just in the last year or two, they've started investing. They want to grow their customer base. They want to grow internationally. And that's where IPO comes in handy as well, because they need the resources to do that.
And what would a successful Etsy in a decade look like?
I would give a 60% odd that they will be acquired. I know eBay is out there. Highly likely that it'll be part of a bigger company at one point.
That was Santosh Rao of Manhattan Venture Partners. Electronic payments through companies like PayPal are supposed to make it easier and safer to buy things online. But reporter Stan Alcorn found out that doesn't always translate when you're trying to make a purchase across borders.
On a strip of beach in Nicaragua, under a kind of thatched roof gazebo, is the Pie de Gigante Spanish School. The school gets website visitors from all over the world. But the school's founder, Juan Delgado, says they don't always become real-life visitors because the website can't actually take their money. He says the system's complicated in that you can only reserve classes by paying with a money order.
Via Western Union or in cash.
Western Union or cash. Because Delgado can't afford to process credit cards, and his Nicaraguan bank doesn't work with digital payments like PayPal.
In most of Latin America today, the only way that you can take money out of your PayPal account is by having a U.S. bank account.
Arnoldo Reyes manages part of PayPal's Latin America business, and he says making payments to local bank accounts means integrating technology with local banks one at a time. That extra work means companies like PayPal tend to focus first on bigger, wealthier markets.
I mean, you can't take an Uber in Nicaragua, and you can't take an Uber in Costa Rica yet.
We're basically closed off.
Marcela Chamorro is an entrepreneur who tried to create a sort of Nicaraguan Ticketmaster.
I know a bunch of small business owners who wanted to sell online, who need to find like a cousin in California who can open a bank account for them and then sell through PayPal to this bank account. And then their aunt comes 3 months later and will bring the cash. It's really complicated.
It makes it harder for locals than for people like Chris James, a British expat who runs the hostel El Momento in Granada, Nicaragua. He has a local bank account for cash and credit cards and an American one for PayPal.
It's easier to have both, really, accounts here and out of the country as well. That's what I find, anyway.
The situation has been changing elsewhere in Latin America. In the last few years, PayPal has partnered with local banks in Peru, Chile, just this Monday, the Dominican Republic. But for Nicaragua, the company says while it's on the radar, it couldn't give any specific timeline. I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
You can find us on Twitter at Marketplace Tech. I'm Noel King, and that's our show today. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.